This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Since this is the first of four or five conversations that are going to take place with Judith, I thought it'd be good to take a step back today, right from the very beginning, and get a good grasp on the breadth of her work, the extent of the practice that begins in the 1980s, I believe, and maybe even in the late 70s.
Late 70s.
And continues to this day. So we're talking about a decades-long practice, and I think that I'd like to start by anchoring our discussion around some of the issues that you have been working on over the decades. Now, you started out as an architect, as we know, and an architect asking what questions such as what is architecture, what does architecture mean, and evidently concluded that architecture is the representation of our social relations in built space. But in looking over your work in the last couple of weeks as I prepared for this discussion, I noticed that much of your work still involves spatiality in some way or form. So let me phrase this as a question. What role do you think that your interest in and understanding of architecture plays in your artwork?
Well, I came out of, that's a good question, thank you. I came out of architecture in the mid-1970s at the moment where the social issues that surrounded May of 68 and some of this, the Vietnam War and many other things were still very much in the air. And this was, I had moved to California and I was attending UC Berkeley, not as an architect anymore, but as a student in the PhD program at Berkeley, where you could actually invent your own PhD. Some of my friends graduated with degrees in écriture, no jobs. But at any rate, I was in a program that was just at the very beginning of film studies and the introduction of semiotics, and many of the second wave feminist issues were circulating during that time. And so I used my training in architecture, and I should also mention I was taking classes also at the San Francisco Art Institute. And so architecture became a way for me I considered it as a methodology, I would say, that I saw architecture as the function and, as you mentioned, the representation of lived social relations, and also as a way of seeing. And architecture, in fact, does produce a very particular way of looking at information and encoding it. And so that had always, all during my very earliest projects, informed my work. And I was also in architecture, there were lots of very interesting architecture practices that came up around that time, which had a tremendous effect on me, which included the work of Archigram, which was a group in London who had a magazine as their architecture, and they basically had a cartoon graphic novel magazine, and they proposed all these amazing spaces. And as a young architecture student, I had thought, how could I make this real, for example? For instance, I had a building in London that was an apartment building where everybody had agreed that they would move the entire building to New York City, and some people said it was 7,000 people, and they'd all made a joint decision to walk across the ocean and the East River and wind up in Manhattan. And, you know, so on the other end of the spectrum in architecture, there was Manfredo Tafuri, who was a Marxist architecture historian, and he was really talking about the kind of demise of futurism, the demise of social programs from an Italian perspective, and he was the teacher of another important architect for me, who was Aldo Rossi, who did a lot of work on memory and the way architecture can provide, through the space it makes, a kind of memorial experience. And if you ever get a chance to go to Modena and see his cemetery or some of his other buildings in Italy, it's you know, definitely an amazing experience. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that Manfredo Tafari and Aldo Rossi aren't, you know, very au courant in the architecture world, but they had a big effect on me, as did other people working in architecture as well.
Mm-hmm. The impact of Tafuri goes beyond architecture, mm-hmm. obviously, but along with questions of how people use space, how people use the built environment, you've also been interested for a long time in performance and in questions revolving around performativity, as well as film theory and feminism, as you said a second ago. How much did these interests play a role in the many, probably over 100 music videos that you made for MTV in the...
Oh, I didn't make 100 music.
Oh, you didn't?
No. I made maybe 10.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you...
No.
Oh, okay.
But I did make a lot of music videos, but not so much for MTV either. But that's another story.
I thought you were making... So the Sonic Youth videos that you did...
Wait. That was banned by MTV.
Oh, so that wasn't for MTV?
No. But I did do a lot of... I mean, I guess music videos started before MTV. They had already started. And my interest in music videos came out of being in San Francisco around the punk rock scene and all the people in San Francisco who were in bands and making doing bands, as well as the notion of using what Christian Metz called the syntagma, which is the smallest unit of meaning, in cinema to tell a story. And because of the way music video functions, where the image and the music are basically two at least story tracks happening simultaneously, and the lack of the need for narrative, music videos let you try things out in a way that very few other forms did. And there was suddenly an audience for this, because many artists were... By then, I'd moved to New York City. The first music videos, I should say, I made were little syntagmas, which did wind up on MTV. And they were 10 seconds. And you could tell a whole story in 10 seconds. But
so were you selling them to MTV? This is MTV before they went corporate.
Oh, right? Yeah, way before. Well, what happened is they actually had seen them, and I think I got $100 a piece for them. Yes, so it wasn't exactly. But what MTV, before it was corporate, was started by two young people who were in their mid-20s. And this is around 1979, 80, 81, 82. And when MTV began, it didn't have any commercials. And they were young, they were interested in artists. And in New York at the time, it was very, very inexpensive to live in New York. It was bankrupt, and so your rent was like $60. And you know, you didn't have to have 20 jobs to pay your rent and so forth and so on. So there was a lot of free time, and MTV really made use of the artist community that was already there around places like the Mud Club and Mickey's and Kansas, Max's Kansas City, and also a lot of bars that were starting to show videos made by artists. And videos made by artists was something that was already happening in San Francisco around some clubs there in the Mabui Gardens and other places where, as an artist, and I did a lot of things at the Mabui Gardens, you would bring your film and you'd cut it into short sound bites or, you know, 2 or 3 second or 10 second or 20 second bits, and you'd show clips of it with music and let things happen. And so it was very organic. And I would say that energy, in my opinion, is what launched MTV. Mm. And the structure of MTV was kind of like a bunch of people sitting around a table going, gee, what would be interesting? What should we do? And we have like, you know, a tiny bit of production money. And so they harnessed, you know, some of the production companies in New York, and they would just kind of commission things from artists. And so it was very organic, and nobody got paid.
But I mean, my point in mentioning or bringing this up is that you then combine architecture with performance to create projects that that involve public space and activities in public space. And you certainly produced a lot of them in the 80s and 90s, experimenting in various ways with which, with what could, in your view, or with what could, or in your view, should be done in public space. So what was that? What was it that you were after with those projects that were probing public space? Because I think it ultimately comes back to this project. So, but let's just focus on the 80s and 90s. What were you after with these projects that were investigating what could be done within the context of public space?
Well, it was a moment when things were very, very performative at that point. You know, when I was when I first moved to New York, almost everybody was still a performance artist, and so performance was kind of the landscape that you were located in. And in architecture too, especially in installation, you can go through an installation, and what happens to you as a viewer user is you're constructing it as you're kind of performing it. And so I began to think about those ideas as being useful in terms of doing this other kind of work, which didn't really have a name yet, because critical theory hadn't really been so absorbed yet. And this is, we're talking about the mid-80s now. So I started to think about, okay, what could happen in these spaces that would have to do with architecture, that would have to do with information, that would have to do with interrogating the space and imagining new forms of space. And so I did a number of interventions in public space where I tried to enact some of these in a kind of installation way, so that the viewer, user, participant really had to construct the meaning as he or she moved through the space. And they would have different meanings for different people. But I really saw that as a way of taking ideas, again, from that really heady those heady moments of the 60s and 70s, like Lefebvre, like Situationists, and many others, and trying to apply them directly in the U.S. because they really, I didn't really see that they'd been so applied here in the U.S., whereas in England and France, of course, they had been, and even to some extent in Germany.
Now, parallel to questions of how built space actually impacts the social world, are questions of technology, and especially new developments in technology, both hardware and software. How new developments in technology affect not only artistic production, but human subjectivity, the human subject itself. So let me ask this too as a question then. To what extent do you think that developments in technology drive artistic production? Or, speaking, of course, mostly of yourself and your artistic practice, do you think that artists use technology, that is, artists use the technology that's available to them, and that's why they turn to technology? In other words, does technology drive what is produced, or do artists have ideas, I'm speaking of yourself, ideas that you will then turn to whatever technology is available to produce it?
That's a really tough question to answer.
Well,
but no, it's a really important question. Yeah. I think in my own practice, and I really can't speak for other people, but in my own practice, I've had different relationships with technology. For instance, when I first started in the 70s, there wasn't that much technology around. But by 1981, there was the introduction of the computer for video editing, and that was a monumental sea change because all of a sudden, there were projects that I shot, you know, just saving up money with my own camera people, et cetera, in video. And then all of a sudden, with the introduction of computer editing made everything really expensive. And this fairly well-known project of mine called Casual Shopper, which is in three versions, 30-minute, 6-minute, and 3-minute, I shot the whole thing and made the whole thing for $3,000. That was kind of a normal, it was a lot of money for me, but it wasn't that much money. The next project, I got a grant to do something, and I took it around to these computer editing places, and it was like $50,000 to make, something equivalent, because all of a sudden I was using technology. So I think it's kind of tricky, the artist's relationship to technology. And what happened, I think, with that particular moment, I think, in the art world, was that it gave birth both to independent cinema, because it was just as cheap to make an independent film as it was to make a video. And of course, what happened in video was that video never really happened. It never got the critical attention. So artists, including me, moved into installation, because it was a much broader venue where work could get talked about. And so artists began using that technology, but not necessarily to make a single channel video or even to go the independent cinema route and make a film. It was more like to interrogate this space. And I think I was part of that group. But simultaneously, at the same time, I think right at this period in 1981, when the computer comes in, you also, and many of us had the same recollection, which is that, we're not in the quote-unquote avant-garde in terms of the production of images, because we don't have access to the means of production. And so then there became this long period, and I think different philosophers have raised the question, Heidegger, Adorno, Benjamin Buchlow, and from Factura to Photography have raised the question, what does technology mean, and what are its uses, and how might it interpolate subjectivity? But this notion of suddenly realizing, like, a whole generation of video, quote-unquote, people, which I was peripherally part of, I didn't consider myself a video artist, suddenly we were going, we're like in the rear guard, even because these people in advertising and the people who make the images that really affect our daily lives on a deeper level are working commercially.
I mean, you're on a rear guard if you consider technology driving the production, but if, as I think you were suggesting, it's your research methodology mm-hmm. that drives the production, and then you turn to whatever, you begin with an idea and then work that idea in whatever medium is most appropriate, then mm-hmm. that you're not it's not a rear guard position.
Right, but I'm just talking about the uses of technology by artists and how that affects what you think of. Because also there was a real mistrust of technology in the 1970s and up all through the 80s, where people really didn't trust technology. Like, I'm thinking of Chris Burden, if you've ever seen his collected work that Electronic Arts Intermix still has, where he's giving a lecture that sets off begins the tape, and he's saying how he feels really uncomfortable even showing people these films of his performances, because he's so uncomfortable that it's not the real event, it's mediated.
Right.
And so that kind of ethos is still kind of hanging over the art world all the way up through the early 80s, and when suddenly the pictures generation burst onto the scene, which I was peripherally around for, not part of, but around for. So, yeah, so it's very, that's why I say it's a complicated
relationship. I mean, this issue of mediation might be a good way to segue into the work that you're showing here at Slot. You began working with immigrant stories quite a while ago, in the late 1980s, I believe, with the project First and Third, yeah. So that was, 87, 88? So why don't you first briefly tell us about that project, the project that first led you to an investigation of immigrant stories, and about related projects, such as the one that you did in Corsica, and I think you did one in Antwerp? Is that right? Or was it Rotterdam?
Rotterdam. Yeah.
So what led you to work these stories, or what led you to explore these stories?
Well,
not these ones. Let's hold off on the Cairo stories for a second. Yeah. But what initially led you?
Yeah, I had just really finally, well, not just, but I'd been in New York full time for about 3 years, I guess, 2 or 3 years, and I was still feeling the pressure that everyone who comes to New York as a young artist probably still feels, which is that it's full of all these people's hopes and dreams. And I was taking, you know, bus rides and meeting people on subways, and they were just telling me their stories. And I was totally fascinated with the notion of how aspiration and the ability to imagine where you might want to be would get you to where you wanted to be. And I was really interested in how the speech acts of people affect their ability to do this. And I began to realize that everybody was an immigrant in New York City. And that happened to coincide with my being invited to the Whitney Biennale in 1980. Was it 88? I think it was 87. So I must have started this project in 86. And I happened, at the time there was this category in the art world called video art. And there were video curators who only did video. And so because of that, it wasn't part of the regular art world at the time. And so as a video person being invited for in that category, I was offered the choice of two places to have my work. I could put it in the bathroom, which is where another artist had had their work, the Whitney Biennial before, Kenny Scharf. Or I was offered the stairwell, but I was not offered the main part of the exhibition. So I thought, aha. So this project, which I'd been, you know, interested in collecting these stories, I just thought, that's it, I'm gonna do that. And so I located these stories, I collected them in a very unscientific way. I had like, I don't know, 12 or so, and so I located them in the stairwell in the Whitney. And at the time, I had previously been using slide projectors and Super 8 film loops to make my installations. And all of a sudden, the video projector had come into being. And what I discovered when I started playing with them is that they didn't have a beam of light. So that actually, if I trompe-l'oeil the projector, the video projector, to look like the limestone walls of the Whitney, the image would just appear and disappear. And it was like magic. And so it was really great to have these stories appear and disappear on the walls of the Whitney. And people would go, you know, how did you do that? So it was like a magic trick. And it was totally because the beam of light in video works in a very different way. It's not a beam in the same way. And so I kind of exploited that. And it turned out that this particular project, because it's relatively inexpensive to exhibit, it was very popular. And so it traveled and traveled and traveled and traveled. And out of that, I was offered other projects, including Corsica and also Rotterdam and something even in Vancouver, I did the stories, but it never happened, and several other places. And because I was being asked to redo them, I decided that I really wanted to have, for each time, a different focus with the work. And so each one had a different métier. For instance, in Corsica, I was invited to do something, and I decided it would be about the fact that there was no 19th century in Corsica, really. It went from the 18th agrarian century to the 20th century, and it kind of skipped the 19th century. And so the project was really about that, and, you know, these particular stories. Or in Rotterdam, it was about housing and the different kinds of housing that exist in Rotterdam. Although the projection methodology was usually the same, because that's why it's a series. I didn't change that because it seemed to work so well.
How do these stories relate to the stories in Cairo? I mean, what do you find to be the most interesting thing about these stories? How much do you like the fact that they allow you to disappear when you turn the camera on? It's kind of a direct cinema. You turn the camera on and the person is talking. It allows you to kind of step back and escape from the kind of auteurship that traditional cinema videotape.
Yeah, well, I like that. I mean, I think there's a long tradition of oral history projects, like, you know, years and, you know, centuries of oral history. And so I've tried to make use of that, you know, that sense of oral history in the projects, as well as to do something in Cairo Stories. I think that's, I did want to kind of break the mold of the series a little bit, because I, first of all, I had the, well, because of the Gulf War, I started the project in 2000 when I, and it was one of those projects where the stories, like with first and third, they kind of found me. I was in Cairo for the first time. I was representing the U.S. in the Cairo Biennale, and these women would come out of the woodwork and tell me their stories, and they were fascinating stories, and I couldn't figure out why. And then as I got to know more people from the region, they said, well, they're telling you their stories because they're not going to tell me their stories or us their stories, because we live here and we would know them, and there, you know, could be gossip or something like that. So that, I found that really very intriguing. And then about 2 years later, I was invited by the American University in Cairo to think of a project. And so I proposed Cairo Stories, and I started shooting it right as the U.S. started bombing in Iraq. So, and I was doing a lot of interviewing on the street, and I should also mention that in this particular instance, none of these women that I was interviewing wanted to have their picture taken or to have their real name used, because they wanted to tell me very intimate stories that they didn't necessarily want to have other people know about. So how the interviews were done, and I've used this method in other cultures where I haven't spoken the language, is we did simultaneous translation with a little tiny tape recorder that's very, you know, non-threatening, with a microphone that we passed around, and I had a group of about maybe 10 different translators, and we would very systematically put out a call to people who might want to talk about their lives and, you know, just interview them maybe all day long, and working with several different translators. And so on the 215 plus tapes, I still have the Arabic, I have the English, me speaking, and I have my translator who spoke English and Arabic. And so that's how it came into being. But the format is completely different. And that was very important to me, because I really wanted to use the format to really make a different representational sign of how these women might be presented, and how these stories might be staged. And so you can see that you can read the stories and you can hear the stories on the, especially on the projector at night, and at night we'll be changing out the stories, so you'll be able to hear all 15 stories in both English and in Arabic, should you want to. And I think we're going to now leave the stories on during the daytime, so you'll be able to hear it if you walk by. And I have to mention, I've shown Cairo Stories where it was just audio without the images. And then I also decided that I wanted to use portraiture and the photograph, because I wanted to underscore something that I think is dropped out of some of the questions about contemporary art now, especially in terms of the photograph, which is that a lot of the discourse when I was a, you know, younger artist around postmodernity and the question of the truth value of the photograph, or what it means to even take a photograph, or how photographs tell the truth or don't tell the truth, or are representations, that's kind of fallen out of favor, not with you, but in many younger writers. And actually, many students don't even ask themselves those questions when they're making an image or taking a picture. Like, what does it mean to stick a camera in somebody's face and snap their picture? And so I thought this would be a really good way of bringing back those issues, as well as I wanted to show the women, who, by the way, are actors, but I wanted to show them in this 19th century, very full-on portraiture mode.
Oh, I see.
And so what happens when you look at the plasmas, which are what the video is playing on, and the photographs, is every so often the woman who's imaged in the photograph, her face comes on and she tells you her story. And so you see the difference between these two forms of representation. I mean, it's very simple, but I think it's, you know, for me, I think it's a point that I felt like needed to be made.
No, it's really interesting. So you decided to use actors because the women that you interviewed didn't want to be imaged while they were telling their stories, even though they wanted to tell their stories, obviously. What do you think, so then the actor is a form of media.
Mm-hmm.
Just
mediation.
Like the technology is a form of media, the actor is a form of media. And what do you think the actors bring to the project themselves? I mean, how closely did they adhere to the stories that were told to you by the Cairo women that you spoke with or that you interviewed?
I had a whole team. So I went back and forth to Cairo a lot, like, you know, 15, 20 times. And I had a whole team of interlocutors that I put together in Cairo. And so these stories were really heavily vetted with them to see what's plausible, you know, what really happened, what does she really mean when she talks about this or this or this or this. And so we, as a group, decided on the stories that we thought gave the best picture of Cairo at this particular moment of time between about 2003, as Aaron mentioned, and 2011. And so then we took the stories and the verbatim transcripts and we slightly condensed them. But the actors that we hired were all actors who spoke both Egyptian Arabic as well as English, and they had to be able to voice the stories in both English and Arabic. And we also, for the shooting, which I'd wanted to do in Cairo, but because during the time I was there, Cairo really became a gated, many of the middle class moved, and the upper middle class actually moved out of the center of Cairo, the downtown area, which is where Tahrir Square is, and they moved out to these gated communities outside of Cairo. And Cairo never had a whole lot of engineering. It's such an old, you know, it's pharaonic and it's, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 thousand years old. And so there are only two-way highways leading out of the city, and the traffic in Cairo is unbelievable. So we couldn't get to where the sound stages were, and Cairo from the 1920s to about the 1950s, 60s had a thriving cinema industry, and there's still many film companies in Cairo despite, you know, everything, and also despite the fact that for a long time they weren't producing films. But all the sound stages were also out where these gated communities were. So long story short, we couldn't, on our production budget, figure out how we were going to do the transportation. So in the end, it just was, you know, impossible. So I moved the entire production to New York City right as the revolution was happening in Tahrir Square. And we brought over about 4 people from that group who were actual dramaturges and people to work on the accent. Because if you're from, you know, it's if somebody's supposed to be from New York and if they sound like they're from California, that doesn't sound right. And if somebody's from Canada and they sound like they're from New York, you can really tell. So it was very important to us and to the interlocutors and to all of the actors that the accent be correct. And so we spent about 2 or 3 weeks in rehearsal working on the stories, having them listen to the tapes and so forth and so on, and then we taped for about 2 weeks. So it was, and the actors were very involved. I mean, you know, they were a community.
But this is a project then that took, I mean, you said you started in 2001?
Well, I was there for the first time in 2000 and 2001.
So, and then you followed it through, I mean, over a decade. So, I mean, to a certain extent, it's a microcosm of women in Cairo and the social fabric of Cairo in that tumultuous decade. Did you notice the shifts? How evident were the shifts that you were noticing, and even the stories? I mean, let's just stick. I'm not talking about your experience in the city, but the stories and the tenor of the stories. And another question, related question, would be how specific is the project to Cairo? In other words, could a project like this, would, do you think that a project like this would be very different if you had interviewed women from a site outside of Cairo, say another city, Alexandria, or a rural site? Is this a specific project to Cairo, or is it a larger project that encompasses Egyptian society at large?
I would say it's both, kind of, but it's much more specific about Cairo, because other than Alexandria, which is much smaller than Cairo, there aren't any big metropolitan areas. And Cairo is a big metropolitan area with many, many different neighborhoods and many, many different kinds of people. And like a city like New York or Los Angeles, it attracts people who are looking for a new life. And so Upper Egypt, which is basically the rest of Cairo below, I mean Egypt below Cairo, is actually for the most part rural. There's Aswan at the very end, there's Luxor in the middle, there's Cairo, and then there's Alexandria all along the Nile. But in between, it's very rural, and it's not unusual for, it's farming families, so you often have people who have, you know, 12 or 13 children, and with one wife and maybe 12 or 13 children with another wife. I mean, you know, so it's extremely agrarian, and it would have been a different story, you know, a totally different story. And I was more interested in, I guess, the urban fabric of Cairo, you know, given what it is, and especially women's relations. And what I found was really totally different than what I initially had expected. Class works really differently than it does here. Women from the upper class have almost no freedom if they're close to their families. And it's not about just an arranged marriage. It's about what's expected of you and what you can and cannot do as a woman. And this continues today. Whereas people from the rural classes also sometimes don't have much freedom because they don't have the wherewithal to have much freedom. And they're often in arranged marriages. And the people who had the most freedom were actually women who had migrated from a rural area and whose family had kind of cut all ties. Mm. And they were actually inventing themselves. You know, so I wrote an article called Said, which I think, well, I know it's on this website that one of my students made called Cairo Stories. And you can read that because I talk about some of these issues and, you know, how surprised I was at what I discovered. Because I going into it, I'm not a sociologist or an anthropologist, and I'm not trying to do that with these stories, but, you know, I found all this really interesting information that really not that many people talk about when they talk about Cairo in particular, which I think is very specific. I don't think it's the same as Tehran, and it's not the same as Istanbul, and it's not the same, you know, as even Alexandria. So,
Let me ask one last question, and then we'll open it up. Do you consider these Cairo stories a form of agitprop, or are they a form of a speak out? I mean, I'm wondering what it is that, how it is that you see this project. Are they topical issues that are being raised, or do you think that the issues, the stories that these women are telling are stories about social conditions that have a longer durée, social conditions that don't really change that much?
Well, I think, I think context is everything. You know, in an art gallery, they function as art, but I have used them as in the kind of speak out form of, you know, and I've used them also as agitprop in certain situations, like I think they can have a very long life depending on how they're interpreted and how they're used. In terms of the social conditions, while a lot changed while I was in Cairo, for example, when I first was in Cairo in 2001, it was very rare to see a woman completely covered with a niqab. And it was also fairly rare to see someone wearing a headscarf of any kind. By the time I left in 2011, almost every woman I saw who was Egyptian on the street, whether they were wearing it for religious reasons or just for whatever reasons, was covered, meaning a headscarf. That was dramatic. And, you know, some of the younger women I was working with, I mean, I started the project in, you know, 2003, and so a lot of the young women that were working with me as AUC students, as translators and around the gallery townhouse, they've all gone on to do other things. One's the editor of Badoon, another one's an Al Jazeera correspondent, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, they're really out in the world now, and they still go back to Cairo and they're just like shocked because it's just, it's totally become not necessarily for women more conservative, but more that the West wasn't the answer. And I think that is really, to some extent, before the revolution, the West wasn't 100% the answer, so a lot of women were wearing the headscarf for a lot of different reasons. And there is a story about that in this series, because we thought several women had told us this about the headscarf. And so we thought, well, we should probably really have a headscarf story in this, and also something about women and women's rights. That said, things are much worse for women now. You know, it's much, much worse, because the social fabric has crumbled. And Cairo used to be a city where you could walk everywhere at night, and there are no street lights. So, and now you can't walk, you know, 5 yards, because every little neighborhood has a kind of vigilante police force that are, you know, local people, and for the most part they're trying to keep, you know, the peace and keep things safe. But nonetheless, you can't, as a woman alone, you could not go walking around. And there's, you know, it's pretty dark there. There isn't a lot of advertising. It's not really that illuminated. And, you know, meanwhile, the social fabric is, under Sisi, it's worse probably than it was under Morsi, because it's a, you know, he's a military guy. And even though people are happier because they have food and the electricity is working more often and things like that, it's, you know, it's not good. So it's pretty tough. There's two books over there that Beth Stryker has done on urban issues that are that I brought, that are, you know, might be interesting if anybody wants to read, you know, more Au Courant. And there's also a book about Cairo by Adolphe Souif, who is a very famous novelist. If those are probably the only three Au Courant books. Plus, there's some books on informal settlements if anybody's interested. And the population of Cairo has more people living in its informal settlements than it does in the census part, the part of Cairo that's counted in the census. So.
Why don't we open it up, see if there are any questions that follow up on some of
the
issues that you raised,
voice.
Since we think we're out of time. Here we go. There are a couple of questions. One, two. Okay.
Hi, thank you very much. So you were there from 2001 off and on, mm-hmm. through 2011.
Yeah.
And then you narrowed it down from 215 stories to 15. Okay. That was one question. Can I ask another question?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
I really like the way that the heads are literally talking heads with like black space around them, and was that part of this magic that you talked about? Was that influence from your background in making walls magically come alive, like you did in the Whitney Biennial? Do you think that is an interest of yours? If you had anything else to say, was that an aesthetic choice to just have? To comment on the one hand, it you know, a photograph can be a superficial interaction. You see it, and all it is a face. And then there's this other layer of the actor pretending to be this real person And then there's the other level of there's nothing but ahead. Would you say that's, could you talk a little bit about that? Or is that correct? Or?
Yeah, well, I mean, I definitely made a conscious choice to have them be in a black background because I wanted to really reference portraiture in art history a little more, you know, also to give them a kind of dignity. And because so many of the women are wearing headscarves, even if some of the stories were from 2003 or something, most of them had changed into the headscarf. So the stories actually represent the headscarves, the headscarf count. And when I was thinking about a background for them, I didn't want to just have a real tight close-up. I wanted to show their bodies and their heads with the headscarf. Then it became an aesthetic choice about what would work and have dignity and not be too dark, but not be too not somber or serious. I wanted it to be very serious. And so I picked black rather than another color. Like I could have picked brown or some other color. I mean, heads can come in and out of, can appear and disappear out of any color practically, especially with video. But I wanted a kind of dark color in order to make it, to give it the weight I felt like it needed to have. And it's funny because even though this, you know, the stories are I think, you know, all very different and powerful, but the weight of the stories with the photograph, I think, gives it a kind of tension that they wouldn't have if they were just on the page by themselves. Although they certainly could be on a page by themselves. So all of which is to say it was fairly, you know, all of this was fairly considered when I went to shoot it and make the photographs and then make the stories also visible. Because another question was like, when you walk into a video and you're not going to spend 3.5 hours watching these stories in English and Arabic, how could you come in and get something out of it if you could only spend 10 minutes? And so I felt like having the stories with the photograph next to the woman and then having them appear and disappear on the plasma next to the larger photograph really gave you a sense of this constellation of women in a way that you wouldn't if it was presented in a different way. Does that answer your question? Or?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Another question over here.
Thank you both so much for that discussion. As you were relaying the anecdote about women in Cairo telling you how hesitant they were to share these stories with other people in their community, I think it really hammered home the extent to which your project sort of created an ersatz public space that was missing and offered a chance for shared discourse that is obviously glaringly lacking there. And I'm curious about the extent to which, as you were planning the project and you were conceiving of it, one of your considerations generating a sort of infrastructure or a kind of community or some sort of structure that would persist after the interview phase, and to your knowledge, has there been a kind of persistence of the sort of discourse that this project encouraged after its conclusion?
I would have liked that to happen. And I think the interlocutors who are still, for the most part, in Cairo are still close friends. Certainly it's something that we talked about in terms of public space. I mean, your question is really a terrific one because in what's called project-specific art and site-specific art and so forth, that kind of work, of course, that often comes up, and I'm thinking of Hal Foster's critique of Renee Green and Mark Dion and others in Chapter 7 of his book Return of the Real, or Miwon Kwan's book One Place After Another, which kind of took artists who work similarly as I do, to task for just kind of, you know, one place after another, nomadically being part of a community and then leaving and not really giving much back in terms of long-term aid or public space or really following through on the issues. And I do think that's a real issue for artists and also participants. And in Cairo Stories, we didn't really have a way around that. But because these were people, you know, who may or may not have even known each other, it was very organic. I started at the AUC with, you know, a very wealthy, privileged group of women, and then young women, not unlike UPenn, in fact. And then out of that, it was like a ripple, and so one story would lead to another, and gradually I got way out into the informal communities. But that took a very long time, and there was a long time of building trust, because obviously the culture there, it's the family, the class system, all of that is figured very differently than the U.S. And gossip is, you know, something that everyone fears, no matter, and that's kind of the unifying situation, I would say, is gossip. And so one of the issues of establishing trust was that we did not gossip, and the translators were not allowed to gossip either. And so, you know, it was, that took a really long time. And then, of course, there are in Cairo, pre the January 2011 events, and even for the year after, there are a number of women's centers and at a number of the schools, including Aswan and some of the others that are more for Cairean people and not for the upper classes, like American University in Cairo is for, you know, it's tuition-based and you have to be wealthy. But in Cairo or actually in Egypt, everybody can have a free education if you can qualify and get into college, which is why the revolution had so many people with college degrees, and the population there is, you know, 50% or more under 25, and a lot of them have a college degree. So, I mean, so there are a lot of community centers, women's groups surrounding these colleges in the downtown areas, and Cairo also, because it is the conduit for aid in the Middle East and also the U.S., has many, 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 many NGOs that do work on women's rights. So there are community groups where people could go. And we would try in our own way to introduce people to one another and make relationships happen. But it wasn't, you know, we didn't make a space or anything, unfortunately. But we would have liked to. But that issue, I think, in the art world, you know, is still an issue. And there are curators. There's a curator now, Sally, I think her last name is Talent. She's at the Liverpool Biennale, and she's been doing 10-year artist project-specific works with artists around the Liverpool Biennale just to address those infrastructure issues. And, you know, so that has become, I think, you know, a part of the discourse of project-specific work, but not in my case. So.
Anything else? Yeah.
Do you consider it a compromise on your part to have used actors? Did you use actors for the previous projects in Rotterdam and other cities? So it's always been part of your artistic vision.
Yeah. And I'm not opposed to using real people. It's just that the methodology of using real people is very, very difficult unless you have the it's really about the subject, the interview subject, as much as it is about the interviewer, because, I think part of the problem with things that unfold in time is that most of us are not going to watch an hour long or a half an hour long story on a monitor, whereas you would watch something that's 3 to 5 minutes if it captivated you. And so that's always the choice that I've been confronted with. And especially with First and Third, when I first started, those were really things that people told me in at restaurants and taxis. So those were kind of short stories to begin with. And I realized that the short story model is very useful in public space. And what's not so useful in public space is the long form. That's why when video art was trying to be video art in the gallery and when it was by the toilet and, you know, no place to sit down and blah, 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 it didn't happen. It wasn't until museums went, oh, cinema, viewing conventions, da-da. And then all of a sudden, video art, which was still video, it was still single-channel video, but it was now in a black box theater. Guess what? 1995? Video art became installation art in galleries. And I think the main reason is that the viewing conventions changed. And suddenly it didn't have to be by the toilet or the cafeteria. And, you know, and so, you know, I think those are the kinds of things that you know, it's about audience, I guess. For me, is that's an issue I think about a lot, is audience. So I hope that answered your question.
Okay.
Alice, could I ask one quick question?
Sure.
But Judith, I thought that part of the notion of using an actor or an actress was to critique the conventional modes by which we represent, so to speak, mm-hmm. other voices and stories, particularly in this case where it's another community, another culture.
Mm-hmm. That too.
So it was like a critical gesture mm-hmm. towards the... you were trying to problematize representation.
Exactly.
And the aesthetics of representation.
Yeah. And that's true too. Yeah, and that's why in all of the stories I have used actors. That was the kind of founding principle. But, you know, since I haven't ever used real people, I'm not opposed to using real people. Since I haven't done that, I do think it's Jean-Michel and I were talking about that. You know, it's important to remember that you're not a unified I when you speak, and that every time that you can't tell a lie, as he said, because you're always enacting yourself, and so. It's always there, and I think that's a really important issue to keep in mind. With you know, and those things have dropped out of, you know, art discourse in the school where I teach, for instance. If you bring up psychoanalysis or subjectivity from that perspective, or even critical theory, it's like they, you know, it's not really discussed in the same way at all anymore. It's kind of taken for granted, but actually forgotten. How I see it.
So now that we have the split subject of psychoanalysis, maybe we can stop here and look at the show a little bit. So thank you, Judith.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you all for staying.